Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, and usual co-hosts Kaylin McPherson and David Moore have been held back from hosting due to the snowstorm. But today on Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley's story about a recent report saying that replacing all fossil fuels with renewables by 2030 would save New Yorkers billions of dollars. Then Nico Nagel-Draby reports on the James and the Giant Peach play production at his elementary school. Later on, Bria Barthel shares book titles for youth that are focused on women's history. After that, Marsha Lazarus highlights Jean Fahey for her 25 years of work to dismantle racism. Finally, we follow Andrea Cunliffe along as artist Ransom shows her around the old Palco Gallery in his current exhibition, Up South, Reflections of the Great Migration. But first, here are the headlines. The city of Rensselaer is asking residents to conserve water for the next few days after a major water main break near the intersection of Washington Avenue Extension and Exit 8 of Interstate 90 took place. Grafton Lakes State Park will host a volunteer open house on Sunday, March 26th at the Welcome Center. There are a variety of tasks that volunteers are needed for. The Environmental Protection Agency on Tuesday proposed the first federal limits on harmful, quote, forever chemicals in drinking water, a long-awaited protection the agency said will save thousands of lives and prevent serious illnesses, including cancer. The plan would limit toxic PFAS chemicals to the lowest level that tests can detect. These were the chemicals found in Hoosick Falls, Norlite, Posenkill, and numerous other communities. The state and assembly have released their One House budget resolutions, staking out positions different from the governor on a number of issues, including the climate, housing, waste reduction, taxes, and bail. Observers expect state lawmakers to miss the April 1st deadline to adopt the budget. As is often the case, the state of New York is leading the nation for residential fire deaths with 45 fatalities in the first 3 months of this year. A staggering statistic that highlights the need for legislative action, according to the Firefighters Association of the State of New York. And that's it for the headlines. Our first story, a new report found that not only is it possible for the New York Power Authority, NYPA, to replace all its fossil fuel generation with renewables by 2030, failure to do so will lose New Yorkers billions of dollars. So Lizzie O of Public Power New York discusses the report and the Build Public's Renewable Act with Mark Dunley.
We're joined by Lizzie O, who is a coalition organizer for Public Power New York. And they recently released a new report on how the benefits would accrue if we were to do the Build Public Renewable Act, which is to get the New York Power Authority to build more renewable energy. This bill did pass the state Senate last year, as people know, but was blocked in the assembly. It has again passed the Senate, just like Governor Cuomo did 4 years ago. Governor Hochul did include something to do a build renewables in NYPA in the budget. So we've asked Lizzie on to give us an update on the new report. But why don't we first start, give us a brief overview. What is the Build Public Renewable Act do, and how does that maybe differ from what the governor's proposing?
Totally. Thanks, Mark, for having me. So the governor's proposal it did give the authority for NYPA to build renewable energy. However, it didn't include all of our best and strong provisions to ensure that it is a truly just transition. So she didn't include our strong labor provisions, prevailing wage, apprenticeship programs, all of that. And she didn't include democratization elements, which would allow NYPA's board to include members of the public. And also she did not include a mandate to build, which would make sure that NYPA actually builds renewable energy. So We are still fighting for our entire package, for our whole bill, because we believe that it is far better than what Governor Hochul has proposed.
Now, this new report, I know one of the things I read was that it particularly looks at, you know, if NYPA was building public renewables, it would be able to pull down quite a bit of money, I think over $1 billion from the new Inflation Reduction Act, the climate package that Congress proposed for funding. But what are some of the key findings of the study?
Well, basically, because of the IRA, we have a ton of financial incentives for NYPA to actually build renewable energy. So New York could, as a whole, save $1.2 billion through 2050 by replacing, you know, NYPA's own fossil fuel generation with renewables by 2030. And we are eligible for a ton of tax credits, which, you know, for NYPA would be direct payments, and also grants from the Department of Energy and the EPA, so that we can mitigate some of the harms that have been done to environmental justice communities. So overall, there are a ton of financial incentives, and it really behooves us to use that to make sure that New Yorkers save money, we save consumers money, and all of this is run through a public authority like NYPA.
And also, I assume one of the key points is that New York has passed a climate law that, you know, sets out, you know, some good goals to try to expand renewable energy. And if the states was going to meet them, one would assume that trying to get NYPA on board to build out renewables would be real helpful, because actually, last I looked, New York State only had about 5 or 6% of its state electricity coming from wind and solar, and that's after 20 years of setting a goal to substantially increase renewable energy.
That's totally right. The report also found out that we are not on our way to meet the goals of the CLCPA, which mandated that, you know, we decarbonize by a substantial amount by 2030 and reduce carbon emissions. So NYPA actually having the authority, but also the mandate to meet our CLCPA goals will actually give New York it will show that New York is actually committed to working on climate, making sure that we are reducing carbon emissions, and also ensuring that our energy system is not constantly being, you know, is not a parasite and taking up too much of, you know, consumers' ability to pay their utility bills.
Now, we're in the midst of, you know, the state, you know, dealing its budget. Governor proposed a budget February 1st. Middle of March, right about now, the two houses put out, you know, their budget proposals. Then they have two and a half weeks to negotiate, usually towards the middle. As I said, the state Senate, you know, already passed the Build Public Renewables Act. The governor has put something in her budget about public renewables. Do we know yet, you know, what's the assembly doing? I know often the assembly will say, we don't want to do any policy in the budget. We'd like to do it post-budget. How are things looking right now in the legislature and with the governor on actually getting across the finish line?
Totally. So we know that the Senate has passed it. We are hearing that the Assembly One House budget also includes big bulk of what is included in the Build Public Renewables Act in the budget language. So we hope, and, you know, we're going to continue to fight to make sure that when Carl Speaker Hastie and the majority leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, are negotiating with Governor Hochul, we get everything, especially labor democratization elements and the mandate to build, and we reject Hochul's proposal, because it seems like the Assembly has spoken, New Yorkers have spoken. This is an incredibly popular bill, and it really is, you know, up to the leadership to make the right decision and make sure that we get the whole bill passed.
Now, when the state passed what's called the CLCPA climate law, I guess 3.5-4 years ago, the big thing that the governor took out, being Governor Cuomo was the labor provisions. As you said, that was not in Hochul's proposal. And democratization of NYPA, my wild guess, is not what the state bureaucrats tend to embrace. So how do the labor provisions and the democratization part, you know, seem to be going, particularly with the governor?
Yeah, well, the governor has included no labor provisions, and labor unions actually and labor leaders who would be directly impacted submitted a letter to the governor saying that they are in favor of including labor provisions in all the climate bills. So we think that a just transition, when we are transitioning away from fossil fuel capitalism towards one that is based off of renewable energy, it should be able to provide really solid green new jobs for working people. And we should also in turn have a say over how those jobs are built and where they're implemented, right? We want to make sure that traditionally disproportionately impacted communities who have borne the brunt of fossil fuel infrastructure are able to also benefit from this legislation. And that means that we need to have a seat at the table. And so we are fighting for those elements. You know, I live in Astoria where we have the most number of peaker plants, right? And I want to make sure that whatever energy infrastructure is being built is going to be benefiting my community and not in the hands of private capitalists. So we want to make sure that this happens. And so we're fighting hard for these provisions.
So we've been talking with Lizzie O, coalition organizer for Public Power in New York, about the Build Public Renewables Act, among other things. In the last 60 seconds, two-part question. If people want to read this report, find out more information, keep up to date on the Public Renewable Act campaign, how can they do so? And if they want to express their opinion to the governor or state lawmakers, how best can they do that?
Definitely. If you want to find out more, please go to publicpowerny.org. That's publicpowerny.org. And you can find more information, read our report, and also express your opinion in support of the full BPRA to Governor Hochul.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Lizzie O, Coalition for Public Power. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Mark is a regular climate correspondent, looking at issues of how we can do more to make a more sustainable future. Our next story is in an elementary school. Producing an elementary school play is a giant undertaking for the young students in it and for the teachers who make it happen. Second grade correspondent Nico Nagel-Driebe reports on this year's play at the Montessori Magnet School in Albany.
Hi, everyone. In February, I saw my school's play, James and the Giant Peach. I loved it so much, I wanted to find out more about how they did it. So first, I talked to my friend, Cyrus, who played the grumpy centipede. Yes.
Why did you want to sign up for a cast member?
Well, I wanted to sign up for a cast member because I thought it would be fun to interact with new people. And I thought it'd be fun to act. I wanted to try something new because my mom actually did acting. Plus, it's really, really fun once you get
into it. I'm in this acting camp now.
That's great.
So, was it hard when you had to, follow the little James and the Giant Peach book?
At first it was tricky because you had to memorize all of your lines. But then after a while, you got used to it and then you knew your cues when you should get in and when you should not.
When did you, start?
Oh, I started about 6 months ago, so half a year.
What were some friends you met when you did that?
Well, I knew a lot of friends there, but I think I got to know... I didn't really make any new friends, but I got to know people more and more.
Yeah. And what grade again?
It was third, fourth, and fifth.
No, what grade are you?
Oh, I'm fifth.
How about the songs? Were they hard?
Most of the James and Giant Peach songs were not too hard. I think Floating Along is the hardest song, and I think Pumpkin Juice is the easiest song.
Yeah. And can you act a little grumpy?
Can act grumpy.
Okay, that's good. James and the Giant Peach, right?
Yeah, James and Giant Peach.
Next, I interviewed my music teacher, Mr. Stone. He directed the play. And my very own teacher, Mrs. Wood, who designed the sets.
So how did you direct it and make the setup for the peach?
So I teach all the music first and the songs. And then after the songs, we do what's called blocking, which is that's where we go through the actual direction on the stage of telling them, all right, when you say this, I like you to move here. When you do that, I like you to move there. And that gives some of the bigger movements, but I like to give the students some flexibility in bringing their own ideas of their characters on the stage. And then if I need to shift or ask them to do something a little bit different, then I do that.
So they were asking how you set up the peach.
Oh, wow. There's like a whole process to it. So I always go to Mr. Stone in the beginning and I say, what are you looking for exactly? So once I get an idea of that, I take out my handy dandy iPad and I sketch things out. And then I go back to Mr. Stone to get approval. He either says, yes, this is great. Or, you know, let's try it again and see if we can do something a little bit better. And once we get that all set, then I actually bring in my projector. People who are helping with the play, they come in if they can, and they help me trace the big peach onto the big flat panels that we have. So once we get those traced out, then we have to go out and buy paint. And then we come in bit by bit when we can, and we just paint. And we use my pictures from the iPad as the frame of reference to kind of help us out, to get us through the process. And that's how we get through that.
And she probably spends as much, if not more, time painting the sets than I do actually directing the show.
I think you said that during the show.
Yeah, she really spends a lot of time on it. And when she comes to me for approval, there's usually not a time where I ask for something different, because she does amazing work in getting it ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Although I will say that the peach that hangs on the tree was probably our biggest challenge, figuring out how we could do that. Because the tree itself was just cardboard attached to the door. So we had to have something light enough that it wouldn't pull the cardboard down, but large enough because it's supposed to be a giant peach.
I took like a bunch of hangers that I get from the dry cleaners and kind of just opened them up and bent them into the shape of a giant peach, and just kind of played around a little bit and found the thinnest paper that I could in the building and taped it around that piece. And, you know, it somehow worked for us, which was great.
How about the house, the Spikered Sponge house?
Oh, yeah. That was pretty much the same process. You know, I drew, well, actually, originally, I drew a different house. And
I wanted it kind of more decrepit and, like,
yes.
not nice looking. Yeah, so the cracks,
yes,
and stuff.
Like,
so that was one of the times where I said, I think this is a little too nice for what we're doing. So then she changed it a little bit, made it look like it's leaning, and added those cracks and whatnot.
And then it was pretty cool because at some point there were a few people from the cast who actually said, Mrs. Wood, you know what would be cool? Why don't you add a sign that says keep out? And I said, let's try it. And we all liked it, so we added that. So we all kind of collectively created the house together.
So I heard someone threw up.
Yes. So the last evening performance, towards the end, and there was some sickness that kind of went through the cast before that. We had to have some people fill in because it was right around the time where the stomach bug was hitting.
Yeah, like Molly.
Maya. Yep, Molly, who played Earthworm, she was not able to be here the first night because she was sick.
Was she there on Saturday?
She was there on Saturday, yep. She was feeling better. I was really excited for her because it's disappointing to put all that work in and then not be able to perform. So I was really happy she was well enough. The second night, Patrick, who played the part of Centipede, it was almost towards the end of the show. We only had about 10 minutes left in the show. He got sick on stage.
Like landing near the tower, or was it a little before?
It was right during Plump and Juicy, right towards the end of Plump and Juicy.
He like froze up.
Yeah, so
he fake froze up.
Right, so in earlier, what attracts the seagulls is supposed to be Centipede throwing up the peach because he ate the peach and then he gets kind of seasick. but yeah, towards the end, he actually got sick on the stage, which I didn't even see until somebody told me, because I'm kind of watching the dancers and kind of getting everything else going. And we just took a brief pause to make clean it up, make sure he was okay.
Was Cyrus even there?
So Cyrus was here. So if somebody played the part on Friday, Saturday, they were the ones helping with all the scene changes and the lighting and all that stuff. So Cyrus was able to fill in for those last few minutes of it. And we joked because, like you said, that he was supposed to get sick earlier and it's supposed to be fake. So we said that he was a method actor.
So what are you doing next? Like, you're not doing one next year, right?
Right. I don't do one every year just because it is a very, very large time commitment. And so when I'm doing the shows, it takes a lot of time away from my own family and my kids' like events. I miss some of those things. And I know same with Ms. Wood.
So like the year after next year, is there any plans already?
So my plans right now, I'm looking at what shows I think I might want to do. And then there's a couple things that go into that. I have to see what the sets are like so I know if we can do it at the school. I have to see what our singing is like with my students that I have to see if the songs are too hard
or too easy.
Yeah, because I want them to be challenging. So I usually like to choose really challenging shows.
You want them to be challenging but not like hard that...
To the point where we can't do it. So I want to do it well, but I want to have to be able to push the students to do better and better and better to get there. Mm-hmm. So I usually set the bar pretty high. These shows, James and the Giant Peach Jr. and the one I did before that, Honk Jr., we're probably one of the only elementary schools that does a show that big and that difficult. They're usually done at middle school and sometimes high school. But I do have a couple ideas of shows that I'm considering. I'm considering Matilda Jr., which is actually another Roald Dahl show.
So you're liking Roald Dahl.
I do like Roald Dahl. Roald Dahl was actually one of my favorite authors when I was younger. When they took his books and turned them into musicals, the people who turned them into musicals really did a very good job, and there's really good music in them. That's one of the main important things to me as a music teacher, is I have to like the music that's in it for me to want to do it. So Matilda Jr. is one of them, but I was also thinking possibly a Disney show like The Little Mermaid Jr. or Aladdin Jr. So I'm not really sure yet. I got to kind of think about it and look at what all those shows entail and see if it's something that we can do it and if I really like the music enough.
In 2 years, I will be in fourth grade. I hope I can be in the play. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Nico Nagel Drebby.
Yes, Nico Nagel Drebby reporting from the Montessori Magnet School in Albany on the James and the Giant Peach production. And you can hear more stories from Nico on our website, mediasanctuary.org. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, and you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Sharing is caring. Spreading the word helps us to do the work that we love to do. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org. And it's time to talk about books, and Bria Barthel went to the Troy Public Library to bring us book suggestions for young people to celebrate Women's History Month.
Hi, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm back once again at Troy Public Library talking with Carol Roberts, head of Young People's Services. She's got some more cool books for us. Carol, let's get going.
Hi, Bria. Thanks for having me. This is Women's History Month in March, and I've got several books that are of interest on that topic. And the first I want to talk about is called, it's a young adult book called Inaugural Ballers, The True Story of the First U.S. Women's Olympic Basketball Team. This is a very comprehensive book about the history of women's basketball in the U.S., starting back in the 1890s and continuing through today. But it really does explore not just the history, but the social changes that were happening at the same time. And this team in particular that went to the Olympics was pivotal in opening the door for women in sports. People like Pat Head, who is a famous women's coach. She coached at the University of Tennessee women's team. And of course, the women didn't have money set aside for uniforms. They had to purchase their uniforms with money they made at donut sales. Pat was one of the original members of this team, and they won silver against the Soviet women's team, and she returned as head coach in the 76 Olympics in Montreal, and she led them to gold. Interestingly enough, there were no athletic scholarships for women in the early days, and each time they played, though, it wasn't just a game, but it was really a political statement and a demand for equal rights. One of the first women to promote women's basketball back in 1891 to 1893 was a woman named Senda Berenson, and she was an instructor at Smith College. And she saw James Naismith, who was famous for inventing basketball as we know it, back in 1891. She saw him coaching a boys' game and asked if the women could play too, and he encouraged her, and that was the beginning.
And that's interesting because this was long before Title IX, but as you said, that they had to do bake sales and different activities to raise money for their uniforms. It's showing why Title IX was so important in helping to sponsor women's sports.
And also, what was interesting, of course, and you might surmise, is that in the beginning, they were discouraged by other people for playing sports because they felt women were too weak. And this would not be a healthy thing for them to do, but they persevered.
Sounds very interesting. And what age group would you say that's for?
That would be grades 8 and up. And there's also, I should mention, a lot of back matter, which is full of an index and information about who won what medals and when. A lot of great info there.
Great. And your next book? We move to picture books. Yay.
Okay, the next book is Fall Down 7 Times, Stand Up 8, Patsy Takamoto Mink and the Fight for Title IX.
So my comment about Title IX was appropriate.
Oh, yes. Actually, these books, they cover a lot of similar themes. Okay, so this woman, Patsy Takamoto, she was the first woman of color elected to Congress. She was from Hawaii, but she was of Japanese descent. She grew up in the 40s, and so she wasn't placed in an internment camp with her family, but her father was pulled aside by the police, and he was interviewed. So she experienced a lot of discrimination in her life, not just for being a Japanese American, but also as a woman. She was denied admission to medical school because of her gender. And what she did was she persevered and she became an activist. She was instrumental, though, in getting Title IX civil rights law passed.
I had heard the name, but I wasn't familiar with her background. The book is interesting. It shows a young girl in what looks like a library and writing letters and groups of people. Why did you pick this book?
Well, because we've recently had the anniversary, the 50-year anniversary of the passing of Title IX, and I was so intrigued by the book on the Olympic basketball team. So this just was one of our new books, and it just spoke to me.
And reading level?
Well, it is a picture book biography, so I would say ages 5 to 10.
Great. And we've got two others?
The next book is another fascinating young adult book, and this is also a biography. This is called Close Up on War, the story of pioneering photojournalist Catherine Leroy in Vietnam. And it's written by Mary Cronk Farrell. This book is amazing. It contains letters she wrote to her parents. She was the first female photographer, or one of the first, to go into combat. She parachuted in with the soldiers, and she had some close calls, including she was wounded with shrapnel and had to be medevaced out. She became close with the soldiers, and she was always taking pictures, showing war up close and what it was like. She's won all kinds of awards. She's gone now, of course, but this book is about her life and how she was one of the pioneers for women in careers and the career of being a photojournalist during wartime. Many people didn't feel that she had any place being there, that it was no place for a woman, and she didn't let anybody tell her no.
And again, this is set in the time of the Vietnam War, and as you might expect for a story of a photojournalist, it has lots of pictures, some of which may be a little disturbing, but it's still an interesting look at photojournalism. And next?
Oh, I should mention also, she was actually a French woman during some of the most difficult years of fighting, which was 1966 through 69. Those were the bloodiest years, but she was in the middle of combat during then. And she was captured at one point, but she was released eventually. I just can't even imagine going through that. But the book is fascinating. It's full of black and white photos, along with her letters. There's pictures of civilians, of soldiers, all kinds of things. And there's brutality in there, too. I mean, that is the nature of war. But it's fascinating. And she was an award-winning photographer and another trailblazer for women.
So three interesting books relevant to Women's History Month. And the next book?
The next book I have is called The Stars Did Wander Darkling by Colin Melroy. And interestingly enough, he is the lead singer of the band The Decemberists, who I had not heard of and I listened to, and they're actually quite good, and I like their music. So this story is actually a horror story. If you could think of maybe Stephen King, someone said it was like a younger version, a story written for a younger version of Stephen King, for his younger self. It's about four friends, one of whom's father is in construction, and they are digging near an old house that's supposedly haunted, and they find that the area underneath is unstable. Meanwhile, something dark and evil has been released and takes the form of three men. And meanwhile, one of the young boys, Oliver, is having visions and flashes of bad things to come. And one of those three men senses this, and the four friends try to save their town from this ancient evil, and including something that occurred nearly 100 years before. So if you like Neil Gaiman or Stephen King, this would be a good book for you.
I love Neil Gaiman. And I was actually just thinking of him as I looked at the back of this for another book by Colin Melroy. It says, A Richly Satisfying Weave of Reality and Fantasy.
Yes, he was the author of the Wildwood Chronicles.
Okay, and if people wanted more information on these books or some of the many activities going on here?
They can just go to our website, which is thetroylibrary.org, or they can stop in and we'd be happy to help them find these or any other books that meet their interests.
Great. Thanks a lot, Carol. That was Carol Roberts, Young People Services Librarian at Troy Public Library. And this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks to Bria for those Young People book suggestions, and she'll be back soon for this month's Adult Book Recommendations. Saratoga resident Jean Fay has devoted over 25 years to bringing Dismantle Racism workshops to the Capital Region. Jean brings a wide lens to her work, having lived in many places both within and with outside of the U.S. This story is by Marsha Lazarus.
If you could change one thing that would create a more just society today, what would that be?
That's a tough one.
What would make the difference?
Just to be able to step outside of the stereotypes that we've built up, whether it's to protect ourselves or to gain resources from other people, and just really see each human being as a whole, autonomous, lovely thing, that each person has something beautiful within them.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Marsha Lazarus with Saratoga resident Jean Fay. Jean will be talking about what can only be called her meaningful work.
I'm thrilled, Jean, to have this opportunity to learn more about your efforts to fight racism, homophobia, and to truly celebrate our human diversity. You bring a really wide lens to this work, Jean. You've grown up in different countries, East Pakistan, Lebanon, Liberia, Switzerland, France, and several other states in the United States. How has this impacted your work? And can you point to a particular instance of injustice that you witnessed or experienced yourself that really stimulated your desire and determination to pursue racial justice in particular?
Traveling all over, especially through India and Asia and actually all over the world, I really grew up seeing extreme hardship and poverty. So I didn't realize it then, but I was seeing the results of capitalist pressure on these poor countries where, the wealthier nations were taking all of their resources away and leaving those people in dire poverty. I can remember seeing in India, we would land in Calcutta, and I can remember seeing a truck every morning driving through the streets and picking up the people who had died overnight on the streets, because they literally lived and died on the streets. As a small child, I had received a lot of discrimination when I was first sent off to school to try and get on the school bus, and the kids would tease me and not let me sit down, and the bus driver would yell at me because I wasn't sitting down. I was kind of caught in this thing. I never understood what that was about. I always thought there was something wrong with me, therefore, and I started to internalize a lot of that negative rejection. And as an individual, I was not growing up in an Asian American neighborhood. And then living abroad, I was definitely viewed as an American because I had all the rights and privileges that an American white person would have, when I was living in poorer nations. But it wasn't until I had a child and suddenly I said, I don't want my child to grow up internalizing these thoughts about themselves when there's no trueness to it.
For the last 25 years, you have been studying race and racism and homophobia and the dynamics of power, and you've designed and delivered racism awareness and people of color empowerment workshops in schools, colleges, agencies, locally and nationally.
I was in my 40s when I first started to actually hear and use the word racism, right? I'd been grown up, I'd gone to pretty good college here in the United States, and there were several students of color there. And I later found out I was the only person of color to graduate in my year, even though there'd been many more or several more who had enrolled in my class year, but nobody had been able to stick it out. And I was working at a college and seeing the students of color that were showing up, and many for the first time, maybe out of their own home, neighborhood, community, and some for the very first time ever encountering real racist and stereotyping behaviors. So I got kind of interested in what was going on. And I was working with the dean for multicultural students. And I was also very actively involved in the local NAACP. At some point in time, we had several racist events happen in Saratoga and around, including a Ku Klux Klan march and rally in Schuylerville, and burning in a cross burning on the lawn of a couple in Wilton, and somebody in Balsam Spa had a brick thrown through, mixed race couple had a brick thrown through their window, and a bunch of people in Saratoga got together and said, "This isn't us." And realizing that there was no body, no human rights organization to kind of bring forward another point of view. So all of these negative racial events were happening, but there was no counterbalance to it. And so they started a group called SEED. And I became the chair of SEED for about 10 years, Saratogians for Equality and Acceptance of Diversity. And through that, we started doing small workshops. I also became a part of the Dismantling Racism Project at the Social Justice Center in Albany, where the executive director had worked with Peace Action in Boston to bring anti-racism workshops here to the Albany area. So as I was sort of pondering, how can I get into helping students graduate from college, students of color graduate from college, I was invited to go to a Dismantling Racism workshop. It was a 2.5 days, it was in Albany. I met some fantastic, fantastic leaders of the movement. And we became a collective training group. And so we worked in biracial dyads, so it'd always be a person of color working with a white person, because we believe that each group of people have different things we need to do to overcome racism. I began training with them. It was a very heavy curriculum. I still find 20 years later, 30 years later, that some of those workshops were critical and still are critical to helping to open people's eyes to understand what racism is. I continued to do trainings and began to develop more and more trainings. And I was working within Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And so beginning to train within that field about how race, you know, really affects who gets raped and who gets punished. And so then we began to include LGBTQ issues within our trainings. And also getting familiar with trauma-informed care and understanding ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences. At one point a few years ago, I was hired with another person who actually had been on the Dismantling Racism team with me. And we did a series of trainings for a college in upstate New York that was experiencing tremendous growth in the students of color being recruited from New York City. And yet the student body and the faculty were not prepared to really truly have people of color be successful with them. Through the workshops that we did, it was a series of 3 workshops over an 18-month period. I truly did see the students of color take on some understanding about the power that they held, and that they were able to begin to negotiate with the institution about things that they needed. And maybe our success is that somebody completes their college through all of that. Maybe there'll be somebody who can just move in the world a little bit easier or a little bit more confidently or be a little more open because of something I said or did decades ago. Until we can get past the doctors who get the exact same resume, one with a black sounding name, one with a white sounding name, and the different treatment that those two resumes get. Yeah. Same thing with job interviews. So until we can really get past that, we are not seeing the best brains that we may have. We're not seeing the best that we can get from every person that can help us be a healthy, thriving community.
That was Jean Fay being interviewed by Marsha Lazarus. And tune into our next program to hear another part of this interview. Andrea Cunliffe takes us along with her as artist Ransom gives her a sneak peek at his current work on display at the Old Palka Gallery, which addresses the Great Migration with inspiration from jazz and hip-hop culture.
Up South, Reflections on the Great Migration, an exhibition at Opalka Gallery. And it's me, Andrea Cunliffe, speaking with Ramson the artist. He's giving us a tour through the gallery, which is being installed as we speak.
So when you first come in, you're going to see the altar, sort of sacrifice.
This is an altar to your family.
Well, it's for people who migrated. This is the altar. So, you know, we have sort of church windows. This is how I sort of saw them. And so they have these arches to the top. And on those, we have pictures, like family members. I wanted to put shelves and connect to that idea that these could be in someone's home. And these are pictures on the shelves of family members. And they're basically saying goodbye to them because they're going to make their way up north. We have a wallpaper. We have something like a bottle, all things of memory, and the house itself. So things that people would remember once they're gone.
I just saw the broom.
Yeah. There's a tricycle here. And then in front of it, we have suitcases. And
jars. Are there messages in the jars?
No, well, actually, those are candles. And those are going to be lit.
And then you get cotton coming in.
Yeah. We got cotton and flowers.
I'm going to go home and make a...
An altar. And then you move through the exhibit.
There's three art pieces that are couples. They're décollage?
Yeah. It's a French term, which means removing a paper. You glue pieces of paper together, and you pull them apart, and you have accidents. All sorts of strange things happen. Sometimes you even wet the paper as well, and sometimes the pink could dye into another color. These are part of my love series. It's really about love in hard places to live, in very rural areas. They don't have a lot of close neighbors. And they're farming, and it's sort of a harsh land, but yet there's love there.
Just beautiful, okay. And yet the texture behind and the color in their clothing. Yeah. I don't know why that emotionally, this one especially, really got me.
Well, you know, they're all hugging each other. And it's something that we all, as humans, can sort of relate to.
And these wonderful pillars, would you call them pillars?
They're called the block.
Okay.
Referencing Romare Bearden's block, which he did a large collage of a New York City street. The idea of this is contemporary. So these are kids of today. We happen to be looking at a mother here, which we have to have, and we have James Baldwin there.
So
everything else over here, for example, this is a young man, but you can change these almost like an exclusive corpse. Yeah, you can interchange them. So on the one we see in the far distance there, we see a man's head, but a female's body. So the question is he transing? Or is he, this is what you see, but this is how he feels on the inside. So those are things that young people are dealing with today. That's what these sort of represent. You know, Baldwin has become very popular again, his writings with the Black Lives Matter movement. And we have a mother who's always watching over us and praying. That's sort of a reference that we'll find throughout the exhibit as well.
This is a lovely collection in the back wall here.
Yeah.
So they're independent, individual paintings.
They're all 8x8 wood panels. There's 100 of them, and they represent the 100 counties in North Carolina, which is where I'm from. And as you see, right in the center here is Rich Square. This is where I was born.
Uh-huh.
And then they're close together, and then they start moving across the wall. They start feathering out.
Okay.
So the idea is they're going out into the world and bringing a little bit of North Carolina with them, which is everyone does when they leave their home state. They bring a little bit of where they came from with them. So that's what this is about.
It's everything from individual people to maps to...
Yeah, well, there's a map on each one of them. And these are cities and areas in North Carolina. Again, you're sort of taking that part where you are from with you out into the world. So flowers, greenery.
Each one is like a jewel.
Yeah, they're like, they're really individual collages that are put together to make one large collage.
Incredible.
That's the idea. Yeah.
What fun.
Yeah, it looks great.
No wonder it took you 2 years, right?
Yeah. Been working on this for a while.
And these two here really stunned me, these paintings. This large one here with two people.
Oh, duality.
And in the middle of their table, which is this pretty little tablecloth.
There's two things in the table, which actually makes an X for, like, this is a target area. Is flowers that represent good thoughts, and the gun represents mean thoughts, violent thoughts. And it's a couple there, a male and a female, and that's usually where decisions are made, and often in homes, at the kitchen table. At least where I growing up, you know, I saw lots of decisions made at the kitchen table. And so the question is, is it violent or a mean decision, or is it a good decision or a more holy decision? And if we look really closely, you'll see a church on each one. It has a church, top and bottom, and each one has a juke joint. A juke joint is like a club, dance club.
Right.
Those are sort of names they called them in the 40s and 50s in the South. And so, again, those decisions you make between church or going to a club. And it's rounds, there's no squares in this. It's even, it's duality. And you can turn this painting the other way and have the woman at the top and the man at the bottom. There's no top or bottom in this painting.
That's really interesting, depending on who...
Exactly.
Where you hang it.
Exactly.
And this one, too, was really disturbing in a weird way.
It is. It's meant to. This is about the history of blues and how blues is in all the music we hear today. Mm-hmm. And so how blues went out into the world. So they sort of go hand in hand, music and violence in this country. You know, it's in the music we listen to, clubs, fights between men. You know, you took my girlfriend. So this is really about blues going out into the world, along with violence as well in America, sort of developing and growing out as the world.
But you can't blame blues. You can't blame violence on blues.
No, I'm not blaming on any. This is really about all music. The title comes from a rap song. Who We Be is a rap song by DMX. I'm talking about blues is in all music, and the violence is in all music. It's an American problem because we have a love for our music and our guns in this country, unfortunately.
This is lovely. It's Sunday going to church.
Yeah, come Sunday. Yeah, yeah.
That's refreshing.
Yeah, after dealing with those things. Well, yeah, so, you know, this is really about how people make a way to go to get to church. That's what this painting is really about. It's about them sort of coming on Sunday. I once read that enslaved people, you know, they didn't have anything to sort of buy new clothes. Sometimes they would have one outfit just for Sunday, or on Sunday they would take flowers and rub on them to create like a perfume. They would try to decorate their hair with flowers and things, which is all part of my practice, this idea of taking what's around you and using it to create something. These people have sort of gathered things around them to sort of go to church. For a lot of poor African Americans, this is the one time they get to dress up and wear that shirt and tie or that nice dress, because that's not the type of employment they do on a day-to-day basis. But Sunday is the time for them to dress up. And so there's a very strong tradition in an African American community to women wearing hats and men dressing up and looking their finest on Sunday, because that's the time they can wear those outfits.
We did.
A lot of people did.
Yeah.
All these things are universal, but they're really universal things that I'm dealing with all the time.
It's the gathering of the community. And I see these people are enjoying themselves, whether they're coming by boat or by horse or hopping over the creek.
Yeah.
It's just really a joyous piece. Well, there's three paintings.
Yeah, it's a triptych. And, you know, the horizontal, the two pieces on the side, and the vertical, it's a church going up higher. I'm not sure where the ideas come from, but that was one that I really liked a lot, the idea of the church being taller than...
And there's a whole thing about the shape of the steeple, that it's meant to... say, point the way to God.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, which I find fascinating, you know. And even in early America, it was the tallest structure in the area.
It's not only the beauty or the religious aspect, it's practical.
Sure.
Here's it safe.
Yeah.
You can see it in the distance.
Part of it as well, the idea you can find Christ, you can find a place of worship where
and
you are.
And safe.
Yes,
safety,
exactly. Yeah, safe place. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
This one.
Wow. This looks stunning. I love it. Well, thank you. Thanks.
Look.
This is about lynching.
This is about lynching.
Yeah, it's about lynching. These are basically boxes, places for sanctuaries for these people who were lynched. I'm focusing on women here.
Did they lynch women?
They actually, women and children and even a dog was lynched with his owner. Because often you don't know anything about these people except for their names. What about them? I want to know more about them as people. So I'm basically asking a series of questions by doing these boxes.
And these nails are sticking out of the boxes.
Yeah, that's to protect them. That's based on sort of an African sculptures that have nails sticking out of them to protect them, ward off evil spirits.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Here's like a piece of a glass, like an eyeglass.
Well,
or a
lock it to be open. This to me is one of the most interesting ones here, although all of them have interesting stories. This one is they're looking for this man to lynch, and he's found with this woman, and they lynched both of them. Originally, they thought that was his wife, and then they realized that it's not his wife. So she's unknown. So the reason why the locket doesn't have a picture in it is because we don't know anything about her. We don't know who her family is. That's why that's one of the most powerful ones to me. So those are the things I'm sort of dealing with here. It's all very hard things, but it's part of a history that we have to reckon with. And that's what these six boxes are for, about those things. Yeah, it's tough stuff.
And this has been Andrea Cunla for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine speaking with Ramson at his exhibition, Up South, Reflections on the Great Migration at Opalka Gallery.
There's an earlier segment about the exhibition, Up South, at the Opalka Gallery. And that was a thank you, Andrea, for that coverage of a very interesting exhibition. And that is our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, and we want to thank all of our volunteers who made today's episodes possible. Mark Dunley, Nico Nagel-Driebe, Moses Nagel, Marsha Lazarus, Bria Barthel, Andrea Cunliffe, and Kaylin McPherson. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary Sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. And we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Media Sanctuary. We're now also on Instagram as at Hudson Mohawk Mag. You can also send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. We appreciate you listening.
Hi, it's Nico, the youngest producer. You've been listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, featuring news and views from around the New York Capital Region. Listen at 7 a.m., 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Sanctuary Radio, 105.3 FM, Troy, and online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also visit mediasanctuary.org anytime to hear the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on demand or to sign up for our podcast.